compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, we are back. Thanks for listening. Let's go now to Tom in Front Royal, Virginia, home of the great Chrissingham College. Welcome, Tom.
Hey, Pat, I heard you say that Walt Disney would roll over in his grave if he had heard what just happened. And as a young kid, you and I are the same age.
I was just saying that, you know, I'm 64 years old, and I was raised in the early 60s. Sunday night was our treat night. We got to watch Walt Disney, and one of the shows one time had this good witch, and everyone, of course, in the town, you know, was didn't like her because she was a witch, but she was doing such wonderful things, according to Walt Disney. And so, anyway, my dad got really mad, and he forbade us to watch Walt Disney after that. And he said, you know, this is the beginning of a series, I'm sure, that's going to show and make witchcraft look like it's okay, and it's not. So I brought that up when you said, you know, Walt Disney will roll over in his grave. But it also made me think that, you know, now we fast forward 50 years, and we look at Walt Disney introducing, you know, the prince that wants to marry a prince.
Right.
And, you know, and where it's gone. So
your dad,
you have a seed.
If I can interrupt, Tom, your dad was very prescient to be able to, if he saw that back in the 60s, that's phenomenal. You know, what a insightful man he was.
Well, I tell you, he was a brilliant man. He actually was responsible for the world having satellite television. He was the chief engineer behind that for General Electric. And he died a very young death. And on his deathbed, I was the only one with him. And he told me his biggest regret was making satellite TV because of what was going to happen. And at the time, I didn't know what he was talking about, but now I can see what's happened, you know?
He could see over the horizon, it sounds like. He saw things coming. Well, Tom, I want to add one thing just so that you're clear on what I was referring to. I'm not here to apologize for or defend Walt Disney. You know, I don't know enough about him to know what to say about his personal character. He may have been a good guy, may have been a terrible guy, for all I know. But I really do believe, based upon seeing the evolution of Disney over the years, that Walt Disney, I do believe he would have been horrified with gay characters and trans characters and, you know, the way it's gotten now. I don't think he foresaw or intended that ever to happen. And so that was what I meant by that he's turning over in his grave.
No, I understand where you're coming from. It just... It hit me with that thing, you know, because it was, for us, it was like, Dad, you can't be serious. You know, this is Walt Disney. But, you know, we see where it went. When my son was 15, which was about 1997, we were not Catholic. But we sent our kid to a Catholic school. And one of the families invited him to go to Walt Disney World. And I said, no way, because I was, you know, I'm like my dad. We all turn out to be like our dads. And my wife's like, oh, no way. You know, he's definitely going. And we got in a big fight about it. But he ended up going. The whole week he was there, it was Gay Pride Week at Walt Disney World.
Oh, my.
And he came back, like, really regretting that he went. He said everybody had on these armbands for Gay Pride. And, you know, if you go all the way back to 97, that was huge back then. Now he's accepted. But back then it was like, wow. It was really,
I remember being at
son.
Disneyland in Southern California without realizing that it was the Gay Pride Day. This was early on. So this was, when was this? It was long ago. And I didn't even know that such a thing existed. And then I forget if it was Nancy and me that were there with some of our kids or maybe even before that. But I was shocked because it was out in the open. And anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
Well, the other thing that this kind of translates into is I'm Catholic now. We get what's called the Catholic Herald. It's for the Arlington Diocese. Mm-hmm. And they have a movie section in there. And I'm just kind of appalled that the Catholic, you know, I don't know if it's a church or who does it, but they list all the movies and they rate them. And, you know, this one's got profanity and foul and blah, blah, blah. And they rate them kind of high. It's like, yeah, but it's okay. You know, it's profanity if you are using the right way and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, why even have it on there? Why not just mention the great movie that comes out every once in a while where, you know, there is, you know, it uplifts people. But they list all the movies that are currently, of course, you know, with COVID, there hadn't been that many, but before COVID, it was really bothering me that the church would go to so much detail to get mm-hmm. people to go to these movies and not really rate them for what they really are.
Yeah, you know, there used to be, and I don't know that I remember this, but I learned about it later, was the National Legion of Decency. It was a Catholic organization that leaned heavily on movie studios if they produced movies that were lascivious or, you know, crude or what have you. They would really mobilize Catholics to avoid going to those movies, and the studios in those days knew it. And they would kind of court the Legion of Decency to make sure. And this actually was the precursor for the rating system that came out later. It started with Catholics in this country who were pushing back against that. Tom, thank you. Great to talk to you. I appreciate it. Let's go now to Blanca in Indiana. Hi, Blanca.
Hello, Patrick. Good morning. I'm very, confused. Right now, I'm in the process of getting divorced. And my question is, can I still receive the Eucharist being in the process of filing for divorce, or it's after the divorce when everything's final that I can stop?
You can, but I'd like to ask you a couple questions if you don't mind, okay?
Sure.
Okay. So who's seeking the divorce? Are you leaving the marriage, or is your husband leaving the marriage?
Well, it's kind of crazy the way it happened. We have been married for almost 30 years. This July would be 30 years. But this past year, it had been just crazy, I guess, for everyone with what we're going through. But it just made it worse to the point that we were sleeping in different rooms. So I'm going to say I did it, but not with the intention that I thought that I was going to get the answer that he gave me. I asked him, if you're not happy with me, then we should just get divorced. And he right there agreed. And I went and I got the papers, but right now I haven't filed because I'm still having hope. I still love him, but his answer is that he doesn't love me anymore and that he's talking to this girl, which is his high school crush. And I left to Mexico for a month, and I told him, just think about it if this is what you really want. Mm-hmm. And I did. I left, and he just called me and said he just doesn't love me.
All right. Let's start there, okay? Were you married in the church? I assume both of you are Catholic, right? You were married in the church nearly 30 years ago?
Yes.
Okay. Do you remember, cast your mind back to that day. And do you remember when you were standing there at the altar and the priest who was officiating, he asked you certain questions and you and your husband both publicly promised to stay with each other in sickness and in health, for better or for worse, till death do us part? Do you remember that?
Yes.
Okay, clearly. That is a solemn promise that you made to God. Think about this, Blanca. That's a solemn promise. That's a vow that you made to God, and you made it to your husband, and he made it to God, and he made it to you. So before God and all his angels and all the saints in heaven and the entire church, you promised that you would not do what you're planning to do.
That's why I guess I feel so guilty, because I didn't expect him to agree to getting a divorce. And like I
Fair
said,
enough.
I don't want the divorce.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I don't want it. I'm willing
then
to
don't
stand
do it.
By him.
Then don't file for divorce. And I recognize that things may be really difficult with him right now. I understand that. And he's already got his, he's got his next gig lined up. He's got his childhood sweetheart all lined up. So for you personally, now hopefully this is not going to result in him going down that road. But my advice to you is, Blanca, think about that you made these promises, you made this vow before God. Can you really look God in the face and say, I'm going to break my vow, Lord? I'm going to go back on my promise?
Right. Yes,
okay, so here's my thing. You said that you're in the process of getting a divorce, right? And you're the one who's going to file? Don't file.
Yes.
Just don't file. Tear up the papers.
Okay, and if he does...
Fire the lawyer. Just hear what I'm saying, Blanca, please. Tear up the papers, fire the lawyer, and tell your husband, I love you. I know things are tough. We can get through this. We've been married nearly 30 years now. We can get through this with God's help, and that's what I intend to do. Now, if you,
this is the pain that I have because, okay since last year, that's what I'm saying, that all this roller coaster, he points all the finger at me. He said I turned into God 100% because I pray the rosary every night for, I have so many things on my plate that it's to the point that they're sort of like, okay, I can't argue with that. So
you don't have to. You don't have to.
But
my advice is though this, Blanca.
That I'm the one that changed because I'm so much into church. I try to do my best as a Christian.
That's okay. That's okay. Here's what I'm trying to get to though. Okay. You asked me at the very beginning, could you receive the sacraments? Could you go to Holy Communion? And the questions that I asked brought to the surface the fact that you don't really want to have a divorce, but now it's like the barn door is open and the horses have gotten out, and now he's lining up his next girlfriend. I understand all that, and those are all eventualities that will be dealt with in due time. But in the meantime, your question to me was, can you, in essence, be right with God and receive Holy Communion? And so the point here is that if you want to be right with God, don't break your vow. Don't file for divorce. Don't do the very thing that would put you into very serious sin. And yes, of course you can go to communion. But if you take this step and you break your vow, you break your promise to God and to your husband, then, you know, you're walking away from your marriage. And that's not being right with God. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes. Yes, 100%.
Yeah. That's all. But that's what I'm trying to get you to see.
Okay, but then again, if he files for it?
Well, if he files for it, then you're the abandoned party. And that would be a tragedy. I recommended yesterday, I'm not sure if you heard the program, but I recommended Retrovi, which is an organization that specializes in helping couples who are on the brink of divorce. They're on the brink of parting company because they can't stand each other anymore. And this organization has saved countless marriages just like yours. Write this down, please, if you have a pen handy. Please write down helpourmarriage.org.
Helpourmarriage.org?
Right. Helpourmarriage.org. Now, my advice would be when we hang up, call them and just say, it's going south. And if you can get your husband to go on a weekend with you, say, honey, before we dynamite this whole thing, this 30 years worth of togetherness, can we please just go on a weekend and kind of sort things out and pray that he'll say yes. And if he does, then go on a weekend. They have them all over the country. And this organization, if anybody can help you put this back together again, this group can do that. And they have miracle stories of marriages that were all but completely destroyed and they were restored and the couples are happy again. Okay.
Oh, my goodness. You're a blessing.
Well, thank God, right? Fight for your marriage. Fight for it. Don't just go along. Don't just sit back and let it implode. Fight for it. And ask God to help you fight for it. And ask your guardian angel to help you fight for it. And ask your husband's guardian angel to help you fight for it. Fight for it.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I pray that this will work out well. God bless you. Let's go to Nancy in Kimball, Minnesota. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I want to know about the giants in Genesis. Mm-hmm. Where did they come from?
The Nephilim, as they are called. Yes, well, they refer to, let me tell you what some people think it means. And for the longest time, a lot of people thought that referred to a kind of mating that took place between fallen angels and women. Now, on the face of it, that is patently not what's going on here because angels are incorporeal spirits. They don't have bodies. They can appear to us in a bodily form, but they don't have bodies and they don't procreate. They don't have the physiology to procreate, and they also, as pure spirits, they don't procreate. So we can rule out the notion that many people do hold, that the Nephilim were these giants that were sired by these fallen angels with women. Now, St. Augustine, as well as St. Thomas Aquinas, in their commentary on Genesis chapter 6, each in his own way, they say that this is, when it refers to the sons of God came into the daughters of men and they bore children to them, these terms are referring to two broad groups of people. So the sons of God, they say, is a reference to those righteous descendants of Adam and Eve who were considered good and holy, I guess. And the daughters of men refer to, presumably through the lineage of Cain, who, as you know, was banished from association with the rest of the people that he was living with at that time, and he was sent elsewhere to other people who were also descendants of Adam and Eve. St. Thomas and St. Augustine say that these are euphemisms to refer to these good people and the people who are considered, from a moral standpoint, perhaps more inferior. And that's what it appears to be. And apparently they were big, big people, big guys. And beyond that, we don't have much else to go on. So I'll stick with St. Thomas and with St. Augustine on that issue. I hope that helps, Nancy. What do you think?
Yes, definitely. Another question, do angels have wings?
Well, angels don't have bodies. Let's go back to that for a second. Angels don't have bodies, so they don't possess wings or arms or legs or heads or anything like that. They're pure spirits. Now, when God permits angels to manifest themselves to us, they have to take some form that we can perceive, some form that we can understand. So it seems pretty clear that in many of these interactions where God permits the angels to appear to human beings, that sometimes they do have wings, sometimes they don't. You know, we're told in Scripture that be careful because you may, without even realizing it at times, show hospitality to angels. And that would suggest that they appear just like anyone else would to us. But they don't have wings the way you and I have arms. They're pure spirits. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yep, good enough. Thank you.
You're welcome. I appreciate it. I love talking about the angels. Let's go now to John in Orlando. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I just wanted to talk about the corruption of Cartoon Network and how there is like main characters and side characters are gay and bi, kind of what mm-hmm. Tom was talking about. What TV has come to these days, and I just want to talk about that.
Yeah, I want to talk about that with you. How old are you, John?
I'm 13, almost 14.
Wow. Well, why don't you tell me what's on your mind, and we'll discuss it. And I'm wondering, are you thinking about SpongeBob and his crew? I mean, I would think they're part of what you're referring to, right?
Not necessarily. I didn't even know about SpongeBob, but some of the new shows that I've just seen on social media that have gay main characters and mm-hmm. gay side characters.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about that. Give me some examples from what you've seen.
Well, on TikTok, there's this one show, I forget the name, but it's like an adventure show. Mm-hmm. And like in the end, like the main character, like confesses love to the side character, like her best friend, but yeah. They're both girls. And then, like, but then her best friend, like, wanted to say the same thing. And I just was like, what the heck? Like, there's really no reason right. for that. Like, the show would have been perfectly fine without that.
Do you think that most of your peers who are your age or a little younger or a little older, do you think that they see that as funny, ha-ha, or do they see it as, yeah, that's pretty normal, pretty standard, or are they bothered by it? Or what reaction do you see in your peers, John?
Well, my best friend, he would think that's totally unnecessary, but some of my other younger friends, I probably wouldn't think much of it and be like, oh, well, it's just a show. Like, it's not like anyone's taking it to heart, but people are. Like, little yeah. kids that don't know any better and their parents don't know what's on the TV, they'll see this and then they'll think, well, if it's okay for them, then what if it's okay for me? And they don't have the testosterone or the estrogen to like, understand because I haven't hit puberty yet.
Your parents must be awesome. Do they talk with you a lot about stuff like this? Do you talk with them about it?
Yeah, we do from time to time.
Well, I'm happily amazed that you are saying what you're saying and that you're thinking about the things this way. That's really great. Please don't, don't give in to the culture, John. We need more guys like you coming up through the ranks.
Yeah, thank you, sir. And I actually have a cousin that came to my house a couple months ago, and she had short hair. She wanted to be a guy. She changed her name. She said she had a girlfriend, which her parents, and she's 11 too.
Yeah.
And her parents, they don't really know what to do with her, and she wants to do testosterone, and she wants to have a surgery to remove her breast. And I just really think that she could be normal if she just had the guidance, you know.
Yes.
And it made me uncomfortable because she was people like that. They just say it all the time. Right. They're like, oh yeah, I'm bi. Oh yeah, I'm gay. Like for no reason.
Are you in public school or Catholic school or homeschooled?
I'm homeschooled, but I'm about to go to a Catholic co-op.
Okay. Well, that's good. One last thing, John, I've got to take a break. Are you familiar with the TV show from back in the 70s called The Waltons?
No, I'm not.
Okay. So I'd like to give you a homework assignment. If it's okay with your parents, check with them. But if it's okay with them, you can get this series. It ran for 9 seasons. It started in 1972, I think. And it's about a family in rural Virginia during the Depression. 7 kids, mom and dad, grandparents. And I would encourage you, and your parents probably saw it when they were younger, but I would encourage you, watch The Waltons. Start with season 1, episode 1, and watch it chronologically forward. And I have a feeling that this will really speak to you because you've got your head screwed on straight and you understand what's going on. Most 13-year-olds don't have what you have. Mm-hmm. But I would encourage you, watch The Waltons, and you're going to see a TV show that even when it came out, things were already starting to get bad. And this TV show is so wholesome. You know, it's not perfect, but it's, I would say, nearly perfect in many respects. And the family values and the relationships between the parents and the kids and the stuff that the kids would go through, nothing whatsoever like what's going on in the world today. And if you watch that, it's like going back in time and seeing what things were like before they started to get rotten. And it's a great series in any case. I think you'll really enjoy it. So maybe watch a few episodes of that, John, and give me a call back if your parents say it's okay a month or two from now. And let me know what you think about The Waltons, okay?
All right, I will.
All right. I'll talk to you again, John. God bless you. I'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149.
You got it.
That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Okay, moving quickly to San Diego now. We're going to talk to Bill. Good morning, Bill. Welcome.
Hello. We have been invited to a wedding, mm-hmm. a relative's wedding, a sibling, actually, his daughter. The situation is this. We got the invitation, and the return envelope was to the couple, both living at the same address. So it's going to be a Catholic wedding, by the way. And it clearly is it is what it is.
Right.
With the two of them, they may be living as brother and sister. I think is a charitable assumption.
There's another possibility, Bill, and I've seen this done before with people I've known personally, where the residence address where they're going to live after the wedding, but where they're not living together before the wedding is where they have the invitations coming from, or the responses should go to. and it's their names at that one address. But in some instances that I've been personally familiar with, I knew for sure that they were not living together, even though the invitations went out that way. So is that a possibility?
Right. Well, I have not asked. I think it, I can't exclude it because we're not mm-hmm. close enough. It's in Northern California.
Okay.
And I can't exclude it. However, yeah. if I had to place money on it, I would go with the living together.
Okay. So how about this? I'm going to take an approach that might surprise you. You obviously don't have the obligation to delve into their personal lives and find out if there's some sins being committed. And I could see, and I think I would do this if it were me, in good faith, you can go knowing, number one, it's entirely possible that the wedding invitations were sent from their address where they will be living together. And without having any knowledge or certain knowledge that they are living together, you can assume on good faith that they're not. And you can also assume good faith because they're getting married in a Catholic church, so they're following the church's requirements for this. And almost certainly, as part of their marriage prep, this issue of living together, if they were at some time doing that, would definitely have come up, and the priest almost certainly would have said, you need to stop living together. Or at the very least, you need to live as brother and sister if for some reason that's impossible. So personally, with all of those boxes being checked off, I think you can go in good faith and assume the best and realize that it's not incumbent upon you to ferret out any possible sins that might be committed. There's enough there on the surface that would suggest that things are on the up and up. Maybe they're not, but maybe they are. And I think you have daylight there to be able to say, we're going to go, we're going to celebrate and assume the best on their part. That's how I would approach
it. Right. Thank you. Thank you. That's comforting. We'd come to that, but you sometimes wonder if, you know, your personal feelings aren't influencing judgment. It's, and I did want a second, you know, and a more mm-hmm. objective opinion.
Certainly.
Number two, I have two siblings who are going to be there. One is the father of the bride. I know for a fact that neither of them attends church regularly, one of them not at all.
Are you talking about the couple?
And no, this is my siblings who are of the parent and uncle generation.
I see. Okay.
We
are you
we
worried about
people.
Them going to communion?
Very much so. And yeah. There was a former wedding, same family, and they both went to communion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the time, I wasn't as aware of their status. I'm now aware.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you, I mean, obviously a sibling, you have more standing in a case like that, and you have more freedom to be able to speak your mind on that issue. So if you're aware that there's something going on in their lives that would preclude going to communion in a worthy way, and you would know all the details, or at least what details you do know could lead you to that in conclusion. So you would be doing a good thing, it seems to me, Bill, if you admonished the sinner. You know, that's one of those spiritual works of mercy, is to admonish the sinner and to give good counsel. So you'd be doing both things in this case. How you go about it, it's probably the tricky part, but, you know, you could remember, or you could remind them, rather, of 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the second half of the chapter where St. Paul talks about those two instances in which you should not receive Holy Communion, whether if you're in the state of unworthiness or mortal sin, or if you don't recognize or discern the body, then you shouldn't do so, because you're, in the first case, you're guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord, and in the second case, you're eating and drinking damnation unto yourself. I've found in the past that by adverting to that passage and just reminding somebody, they may not even know about that passage, but just remind them that this is something that is quite serious. And then my thought, Bill, is if you make him aware of it, could be an email, you know, hey, I'm really looking forward to seeing you. Can't wait to see your family. It's been a long time. And I was thinking about communion at Mass, and I don't know, you know, it's not my place to know who's ready and who's not ready, but for the sake of those who will be at the wedding who, you know, may not be Catholic or they may not be prepared to receive Holy Communion, this passage, I think, speaks to that issue. Then you can know that you have, you've instructed him. You've said the truth. He now knows it. If he didn't know it before, he now knows it. And so what did the Lone Ranger used to say? My work here is finished. You know, it doesn't mean that you can't continue a conversation with him, but at least you know that you don't have to belabor the point because you've made him aware of it. What he does with it is up to him, of course. But you've then fulfilled your obligation to try to do something, you know, to try to gently, tactfully do something. And the upside for you, Bill, is you won't have to look back later in life and say, I wish I had said something, because you will have said something. And then it's up to him.
Thank you. That is a solution I had not thought of, and it keeps it quiet. And one of them I know will continue speaking to me. The other, for all I know, he'll stop talking to me after I send that to him. But c'est la vie.
What a shame. I'm sorry to hear that. Families can be weird, can't they, Bill? There's all kinds of family weirdness in every family. It's remarkable.
If there's not weirdness, you're not living in a family, I think.
So true. Well, I hope it's a beautiful wedding, and I hope you and your wife are having an enjoyable time there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Great talking to you. Now we'll talk to Bonnie in Franklin, Wisconsin. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I belong to a centering prayer group, and we're still Zooming because nobody wants to get together actually as yet. But what we do is we pray, you know, for 25 minutes, and then we move into Lectio Divina, and we use the Sunday scripture, the gospel. Mm-hmm. And the last couple of weeks, it's been on John's gospel and the bread of life scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two people in our group that are not Catholic. And so in Lectio, what we do is we read the scriptures twice. And
Bonnie, forgive my interruption. We only have a couple of minutes before the break. Could you, I don't know, maybe summarize your question?
Still, yeah. It's I didn't exactly know what to say about these scriptures. And basically, there's a time for sharing.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know what to share. I wanted to talk about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. I wanted to talk about Orvieto and the Eucharistic miracles. Mm-hmm. And I wound up saying absolutely nothing because I wasn't sure that what I would say wouldn't offend someone.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, St. Paul talks in Romans chapter 1 where he says, I am not ashamed of the gospel. And boy, did he have plenty of opportunities to pull his horns in and not say anything, because, man, he took a beating over and over again, and literal beatings, by the way, stonings, beating with rods, 4 times, lashed 40 times minus one. He talks about this. I think I quoted the passage a couple of days ago. So he put it out there knowing that some people were going to just be offended and worse, and that didn't stop him. So I don't propose that anybody, certainly not yourself, that anybody be obnoxious about it or pushy or arrogant or any of those things. In fact, we should avoid those demeanors. But at the same time, if there's an opportunity for you to speak the truth in love, you know, let it rip. And if they're offended, okay, they're offended. But you still have done what you can do to try to teach them the faith and let them know about this great gift that God wants them to have in the Holy Eucharist. So I would encourage you not to be timid in the future. Be tactful, but not timid. That'd be my suggestion.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
And you know what? You just might have somebody thanking you down the road saying, wow, I'm so glad you spoke up, because if you hadn't, I never would have become Catholic. Isn't that a nice thing? Could happen. Hey, by the way, Bonnie, one other thing before you go. I am not a fan of centering prayer. And I'm not knocking you at all, but I would encourage you to read an article at Catholic Answers. Their website is catholic.com, about the dangers of centering prayer. And it gets into, you know, how did this come about? And Abbot Thomas Keating and some of the other people who are involved with promoting and kind of starting centering prayer. It's a critique of that and some of the issues that are involved with it. And it's one of several articles that gets into some of the concerns about centering prayer. So I would encourage you to read those. In fact, we'll get a link to one of those posted for you on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. Or if you just want to go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, you'll find the Twitter feed there as well. And just, you know, read the article and think about it a little bit. I think that would be helpful too. Thank you. I'll be right back with the rest of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Ricky, don't lose that number. You don't want to call nobody else.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Ricky, don't lose.
Let's go now to Sarah in Los Angeles. Good morning, Sarah.
Hi, good morning. I had a question regarding choosing a confirmation sponsor.
Sure.
My daughter was recently enrolled in year two confirmation, and I expressed concerns to the coordinator about really not having anyone in our lives that would be a good sponsor. Mm-hmm. I'd like somebody who's really living the Catholic faith and not Catholic in name only. Mm-hmm. And she kind of advised me like I was kind of aiming too high and maybe I should settle for someone who isn't, mm-hmm. you know, living out the faith. And I was kind of surprised by that and wanted to know if you had any suggestions on what I should do.
Right. Because who wants to settle if you don't have to settle? You know, it's always good to aim high and hit high. So the remember that the church has certain laws that govern such things. So one of the church's canons that govern this, canon 892, it says that the primary responsibility of a sponsor is to take care that the confirmed person behaves as a true witness to Christ and faithfully fulfills obligations inherent in his sacrament, in this sacrament. So if the sponsor who's chosen more is just a ceremonial duty or something like that, but doesn't really practice the faith himself or herself, then he or she is not in a position to be able to fulfill this solemn obligation. So that's why you should aim high. You should look for sponsors who will fulfill this to the best of their ability. And obviously things change and people have difficulties in life, and I mean, heck, there have been a couple situations where godparents, for example, that my wife and I chose long ago for our children to be baptized. And, you know, in some cases, the godparents or one or the other, as the case may be, wound up leaving the church or not practicing the faith anymore. So it happens. But you can't read the future. You don't know the future, and God doesn't expect the impossible from you. So what the church proposes to you is do the very best you can. And if you, as you said, if you have to settle because the person that you've settled upon is not your first choice or is not the best example, you do the best you can and leave it in God's hands. But I would work really hard to try to find a good sponsor, and that could include somebody that you're not close to. There may be a couple in the parish, and you've noticed how devout they are. Maybe mom and dad of a large family. People that have shown by their actions and their witness that they are serious about their Catholic faith. There'd be nothing preventing you from striking up a conversation and investigating and seeing maybe one of them might be willing to be the confirmation sponsor. I mean, that's another creative way to go about doing it. It doesn't have to be a family member. It can also be a friend, could be a fellow parishioner. So there are other options out there. I would encourage you to pursue that and see what's out there.
Okay. Is it okay for my daughter to have a male sponsor? Because that was something I wasn't aware of, but apparently they said it could be a male or female that's the confirmation sponsor.
Yeah, that is possible. So a man could be the confirmation sponsor for a girl or a woman and vice versa. It's not common. but there's nothing, you know, about that that the church forbids. Obviously, okay, you want to make sure that, you know, the person is chosen is on the up and up and is, you know, is an upright and morally good person, especially if they're close in age to the person being confirmed. But no, there's nothing prohibiting that.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for your input. It's helpful.
You're welcome. Yeah. And you'll look back on it later and be glad you made the extra effort, Sarah.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. For what it's worth, I've been honored by being the godfather and in some cases a confirmation sponsor of a number of young people. And without getting into any specifics whatsoever for the privacy of the person involved, there have been a couple of times with different people that I've been either the godfather for or a confirmation sponsor where I've had to, you know, talk to this person as a young adult and say, hey, you're messing up. You shouldn't be doing that. What? Hey, look, I'm your godfather. You know, I made a promise to God and to your parents and to the church and to you, even though you were a little baby, that I would do everything I could to try to help you grow strong in the faith. And you're not doing that right now. And I have an obligation to remind you. And that's sometimes called for, you know, as you get further into life, sometimes it's necessary. In the meantime, though, you know, to maybe get some good Catholic religious books as gifts every so often for your godson or for your the confirmand that you've sponsored. These are all things that you can do, little nudges in the right direction. And occasionally, maybe you have to do something a little more drastic by admonishing the person, but you can and you should. And this is why we have godparents in the first place. This is why we have confirmation sponsors in the first place. It's not a ceremonial duty. It's not merely perfunctory. You actually really do have an obligation to do what you can. And I suppose this is a topic that needs more attention because a lot of people, they think, well, it's just, you know, it's just a ceremonial function. I don't really have to do anything, but I'm the godfather. It's much more than that. How about Maria now in Peoria, Arizona? Hi, Maria.
Hello, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm being troubled some a little bit because I just lost my husband on July 14th
to
a very rare disease. He suffered
like
for 4 years. We both suffered. But thank you very much. And I'm practicing Catholic religion very deeply. I am originally from Poland. And my faith is very strong. My husband received all the sacraments. He's suffering. He loves praying.
Now that you're referring to your husband who passed away, is that right?
I'm sorry, I'm losing you.
Oh, I wanted to make sure I understood you. You're referring to your husband who passed away?
Correct.
Okay. So what would be... I guess what's the question that you want to ask me, Maria?
What's the question? I have a dialogue with the two priests. And one tells me that what's in my heart, where he's at right now, like in heaven. And the other one tells me, I'll tell you when he's going to go to heaven. So that tells me that it's either he's having some kind of visions and my husband is not in heaven yet, but he passed away with a scapular on.
And let me jump in. The priest, God bless him, bless his heart. He has no ability to tell you when your husband has gone to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't put any stock in that at all. Pray for your husband, as I'm sure you already are. Pray, offer masses for him in the repose of his soul. Pray the rosary every day. You can take comfort in knowing that Our Lady of Mount Carmel promised that those who die wearing the scapular of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, and of course it has to be in faith and trusting in Jesus for salvation, etc., but as a reminder of her loving intercession, one of her promises is that she will pray in a very particular way, very powerful way, so that the person, if he's in purgatory before going to heaven, will be released sooner, like by the following Saturday. And it may not be exactly the case in each individual instance, but those are promises that you can be comforted by. But I wouldn't put any stock in anybody, whether a priest or a layperson, telling you that he or she can tell you when your husband leaves purgatory. That's nonsense. So I would just ignore that.
Makes me feel better.
Yeah. Just ignore
that.
Okay. I've got to press on, Maria. I send you my heartfelt and sincere condolences. It must be very painful for you. And I'll ask everybody listening right now, not only to pray for you, and your comfort, but also for the repose of your husband's soul. Amen. Let's go now to David in Austin, Texas. Hi, David.
Hi, Patrick. My situation is as a member of a parish council meeting with the priest as a witness and a parish council member to terminate someone has volunteered in a ministry for 45 years, and the priest feels like the talents are no longer needed, but he's decided a couple years ago to dismiss them, and he kept putting it off, which I don't blame him for
that.
Is
it a paid position, or is it a volunteer position?
It's a volunteer position.
Okay. And it's a layperson, I assume?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's put the parish council members in a bad position, whereas he's indicated that it was the parish council's choice to do this, when in fact it was just his, and he's had issues with this person.
So how can I help?
He's going about it. Well, what does a parish council member do, another brother in Christ, within the meeting when the priest is rude, shouting, and not compassionate to this person?
Oh, that's unfortunate to say the least. So the priest was losing his composure and publicly shouting at this person?
Well, the meeting hasn't happened yet. He's lost his composure in his emails to this person. And been very derogatory, and face to face in front of others has reprimanded her.
Is she doing anything untoward? Is she doing something that is objectionable?
No, it's strictly his attitude is that her talents are just no longer needed. And, you know, that's not for me to discern, but he's put the parish council on the spot when he's in charge of the parish council.
I see.
And it was his decision entirely.
And he wants the parish council to vote on this or something like that?
Yeah, he did, but they didn't take a vote. We didn't take a vote. Mm-hmm. And now he's putting us on the spot that we made the decision and not him. But
I've met people like this.
The sad part about it is, it's just, how do you respect the priest, be honorable, and also you have to defend the person and their dignity.
Yeah.
And you know, it's hard to sit there and put up with this and take the blame for it when it was his decision.
Right. Here's what you could do. You could compose a calm, well-reasoned email to him. Dear Father, peace in Christ. As you know, over the last X number of years, you have been against this person helping out at the parish. And you've said this and you've asked this. It's come to the point now where it looks as though you want the parish council to do what it sounds to me like what you're saying, Davis. He wants you to be the hatchet man, or collectively as a parish council, so that you guys are the ones that do his dirty work. And you can say, you know, I personally don't think that she needs to go, if that's how you feel. And you can praise her efforts and her long-standing generosity, giving so much of her time to the parish, and doing so for many years before you ever came to the parish, Father. And she's a good person. She doesn't deserve to be treated like this. And I would just encourage you, I would implore you even, to be gentle and respectful of somebody who's donated so much of her time for the parish. So I just want to go on record. I don't support this. If you're going to call a vote from the parish council, please be aware that I will not vote in favor of it. And you could add, if it's true, you could say, and I'm aware that other members of the parish council feel the same way I do. And I hope you will rethink this and decide on a different course of action. You could send an email like that. And what that does is, first of all, that documents all of these issues. So no one can ever later say, well, David in Austin, Texas, you know, he said. No, you can say, this is what I said in black and white. The other thing is, it gives you an opportunity to come to this woman's defense. And as you said, to be honorable and to be helpful in her regard. It also, I think, would serve as maybe a bit of a curb if the priest is just being willful. And maybe he's not. Maybe he knows more about this than you do. And there's something more to it that he's not able to share. That's entirely possible, too. I don't want to paint the priest with that brush, because anything is possible. But at the very least, you know in your conscience, David, that you have done something in a positive way, a constructive way. You tried to help this other person, and you did it respectfully to the priest. So there's nothing disrespectful about writing an email like that. Now, how he responds to it, only time will tell. But at least then you can look back and say that you really did do something substantive, and you tried, and maybe that'll be all the difference. Maybe things will get better because of you. Maybe they won't. But even if they don't, at least you know that you did the right thing because you made the effort to do it. I wish you had more time, but I hope some of that's helpful to you, David. It's sad when these situations arise. I hope there's a happy outcome. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow, same Pat time, same Pat channel. And I, as I do every day, will pray for you. I ask you to please pray for me. God bless you.